Hello, and welcome to the Full Circle Healing Podcast, where we merge modern, cutting-edge science with traditional healing wisdom and everything in between to help you come full circle back to your original natural state of health and well-being. I'm your host, Michael, and over the past 15 years, I've helped hundreds of thousands of people find the information, practices, tools, resources, and experts they needed to find their way back to optimal health. Our guest in this episode today is our friend and leading women's expert, Dr. Jessica Drummond. Dr. Drummond is the founder and CEO of the Integrative Women's Health Institute and the best-selling author of Outsmart Endometriosis. She has 22 years of clinical experience as a licensed physical therapist, clinical nutritionist, and board-certified health coach working with women with pelvic pain, including endometriosis, vulvodynia, and bladder pain syndrome. Jessica brings a unique, conservative, and integrative approach to supporting women to overcome hormonal imbalances and chronic pain conditions. A sought-after international speaker on topics such as integrative pelvic pain management, natural fertility options, optimal hormone health, menopause, and female athlete nutrition, with educational programs that have reached thousands of clients and professional students in over 60 countries. In this episode, you'll learn why there are skyrocketing rates of autoimmune disease and other chronic conditions in midlife women today, how hormonal shifts during perimenopause and menopause amplify the risk and severity of conditions like long COVID, why histamine issues, dysautonomia, conditions like POTS, and chronic fatigue are often part of a larger interconnected health picture, and practical science-based steps to stabilize symptoms and improve quality of life based on Dr. Drummond's own journey with long COVID. As you will learn, the state of our nervous system plays a huge role in the development and reversal of many chronic illnesses. If you'd like to learn some breathing practices that can help bring regulation to your system, as discussed in this episode, head over to rebelhealth.co/breathing and grab our Breathing for Nervous System Regulation ebook. Now let's jump into this urgently important conversation with Dr. Drummond. And we're live. Welcome, Dr. Jessica Drummond, to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, it's super fun, always. We just recorded a masterclass presentation a couple weeks ago, and we're just joking that we're going to start recording our pre-recording conversations pretty soon to make another podcast, and we'll get to that. We'll talk about that another time. But for today, we're going to talk about something that you guys at your institute have put together and are kind of putting out into the world as we are recording this. Is the topic is complex chronic illness, specifically in women who are at perimenopause, menopause, middle age, a little after, and that there's these trends that are happening where that demographic specifically is seeing huge rises in things like autoimmune disease, endometriosis, mast cell activation syndrome, and now the new player on the team is long COVID. And I'm excited to learn what you have been witnessing, unfortunately, kind of as a firsthand spectator, right?
Yeah. So I have a personal experience over the last 4 years with long COVID, which hit me at age 46. So I was in very good physical condition at that point, although I did have some of the vulnerabilities, some of the Achilles heels that many of my clients and our population that we're working with in the Menopause Solution Program have. One, history of kind of problematic post-viral illnesses. So I had mono in high school and then, you know, took a while to recover from that and then got it again, like right before I went to college. So, you know, within the same like year and a half. And then when I, just after the birth of my daughter, I had my first daughter who's almost 21. I had a, you know, reactivation of Epstein-Barr, which I, you know, pretty knocked me back from a health standpoint for about a year, year and a half. And also, though, these underlying vulnerabilities, and we're seeing a sort of comorbidity picture that I've seen for the last 25 years in my practice in endometriosis, but we're seeing this kind of show up in a number of different quote unquote diagnoses. And it could be for women of any age. So yesterday I had a patient who was 20 who has endometriosis, and she has this, you know, overlapping bucket of comorbidities. And we'll talk about what those are in just a second. And we're seeing this in perimenopause. So for younger women, it can be triggered by things like stress or a new viral infection, such as COVID. And for older women, so the average age of long COVID is 46.8. So right smack dab in the middle of perimenopause. And a lot of the symptoms look the same. So it is often the viral infection, but it's in the context of declining or inconsistent estrogen. So changes and shifts in estrogen. And even for my younger clients, I have a couple of women in their 30s who had COVID a few times, did fine, recovered reasonably well. And then the second or third or fourth infection, they were hit during the luteal phase, like just before their menstrual cycle, their period started. So at the end of the cycle, beginning of the next cycle, when estrogen is at its lowest. And that's when the long COVID presentation was triggered. So this group of comorbidities, which I think looks a lot like vulnerabilities early in life, and then with these multiple other stressors and triggers, becomes more fully expressed. And that is some kind of histamine issue. So women will say, oh, you know, when I was a kid, I always had really bothersome mosquito bites, or I randomly break out in hives, or I have a lot of food sensitivities or bloating, things like that. So those are all signs of histamine issues or mast cell activation syndrome. Dysautonomia, which is sometimes fully diagnosed as a certain version of dysautonomia. The most common one is POTS, which is postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, meaning when you stand up, you feel like you're going to pass out and your heart rate jumps up. And so we've got histamine issues, dysautonomia, and chronic fatigue or myalgic encephalomyelitis, ME/CFS. I also see chronic pain type conditions such as endometriosis or even other kind of chronic pain areas. But ME/CFS will present as fatigue, but it's not just I'm tired. It's like I went out and did some activity. Sometimes it's light activity. Sometimes it's cognitive activity. Sometimes it's social activity. And then later, or even the next day or 2 days later, there's a real backslide, a real like decline and in symptom exacerbation, deep fatigue. So these three things together are kind of underpinning the kind of weird symptom picture that isn't very well managed in conventional medicine, because at best you get a specialist in each of these areas, but it's very rare that anyone is sort of coordinating this picture. And then my question, having been experiencing this myself and kind of looking at my life history, and I've even dug into some of my genetic vulnerabilities, because there's a fourth thing that often kind of goes along with this, and that is hypermobility syndromes like Ehlers-Danlos. And I have some genetic tendencies towards those, although perhaps not a complete picture for diagnosis. And so when you look at this combination of hypermobility, histamine issues, chronic fatigue, and dysautonomia, the question to me is, what is really, really the root? The good news is we have groups of treatments, if you will, that can help somewhat manage the symptoms, although it's not a home run. Some people are pretty disabled from this. But usually we can significantly improve the symptoms. But the question is, what is at the root? And increasingly, because almost everyone at this point has had 1 to 3 to 4 or more COVID infections, it's possibly viral persistence. And we've seen this in new research about multiple sclerosis having its root in a viral persistence of Epstein-Barr virus. Now, most people have had Epstein-Barr virus at some point, but a certain percentage, that is sort of the underlying cause of multiple sclerosis. So it begins to have us questioning, what does autoimmunity really mean? Is the immune system really just attacking its own self, its own systems, the human's own systems? Or are there viral reservoirs that it's trying to clean up? Or both? It could be the case that the immune system is stuck in a dysregulated pattern that was maybe triggered. I've also seen in my practice it triggered by vaccination. So either or. And some people have never been vaccinated and have this. Some people only have this from vaccination. So it's a little hard to tell. Also, some COVID infections are silent. So it's hard to tell if you had a COVID infection before your vaccination. So I think we can take all of those things off the table. The answer is for some people, yes, it's any or all of the above. But you're not protected if you've never been vaccinated, and you're not protected if you have been vaccinated. You can be protected from certain things from vaccine, but not from long COVID necessarily. And it may actually, in certain people, make it worse. So what we have to look at is, why is the immune system so messed up? And the answer is, we don't know. We do know in COVID that viral reservoirs can live pretty much anywhere in the body. The brain seems to be a big area where it settles, but it can be really anywhere for at least 2 years. That's how long the studies have gone on, but it's not like right after 2 years it just clears up. It's just that's when they stop the studies.
Perfect. Thank you for sharing all of that. I took a lot of notes. The comorbidities you're talking about are related to likelihood of developing long COVID? Or are you just talking about this as a general pattern of women that you're seeing a lot that have the histamine issues, the dysautonomia, the fatigue, the hypermobility that you're supposing could be related to a viral persistence? Are you saying that those are comorbidities that tend to predict or increase likelihood of long COVID situations?
Yes. And I'm also seeing women who, whether they had had COVID or not, may have had this sort of constellation of vague symptoms just triggered by perimenopause, or, you know, the hormone shifts of perimenopause, or just triggered by things like a mold exposure or even a stressful life event, like a divorce or a move or something like that. And unfortunately, in my population, which is primarily women, either younger women with endometriosis, but in the population of women we're talking about here, women from their late 30s to early 50s, it's almost never that just one of these things has happened. But when I talk to my colleagues, even in the endometriosis space, even among my medical colleagues, there is something about COVID that is making this environment more difficult for midlife women to tolerate. So having had a COVID exposure or multiple COVID infections or multiple combinations of COVID and COVID vaccine, it's even harder to tolerate the life stressors that come along with this age, you know, juggling parents and teenagers and marriage issues and moving and work and all the regular life stressors, which are significant at this age, and the changes hormonally that happen in perimenopause and menopause. It is hard to say, like, if we start to look back generations, so 50, 100 years ago, did women have fewer perimenopause symptoms? We honestly don't know, because of how women were in society. Even if they were having symptoms, there was really no recourse for them. They often just wouldn't talk about it. And they, other than a very short time in the 70s, they didn't really have access to hormone therapies. So there wouldn't be any therapies for them anyway. They would be put on antidepressants at best, but most of them probably just silently weathered it. Was it better? Was it worse? We just don't really know.
Okay. Yeah, it makes sense, because there was such a lack in attention or studies or research or anything. It's the same way I have a master's in exercise physiology, and like 97% of the studies or something that were cited in my master's program were done on men.
Exactly.
And so, yeah. You mentioned before you got into the comorbidities in this kind of conglomerate of symptoms and dysfunctions or conditions or whatever you want to call this that you're seeing, vulnerabilities are Achilles' heels. You mentioned post-viral illness that you had, mono twice, and Epstein-Barr reactivation. Are there others that tend to, because I guess what I'm seeing is the pattern would be that the theory here is that there's something viral or post-viral related to, or viral reactivations, but something related to virus that's contributing to this conglomerate of symptoms. And I haven't worked one-on-one with clients in a while, but we have a lot of these complex chronic illness people in our communities, and they always list more than one of these things when they list their things. It's never somebody, oh, I only have POTS.
Mm-hmm.
If they have POTS, they almost always have
Ehlers-Danlos.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Or chronic fatigue or histamine or mast cell or something. Like it's this conglomerate. And I've heard other theories as to what's going on there, but was there anything else with Achilles' heels or vulnerabilities you mentioned at the beginning?
Yeah, I think, what you just said, having one of them is sort of a red flag that you've got some genetic underlying risk factors for multiple of these, and that they're all kind of related. The first one will often be something like endometriosis, because that tends to present younger. It could also be painful bladder syndrome, anything that's kind of got like a burning pain component. Migraines is another one. And then another trigger. So I think some of the triggers, it's like we have these underlying vulnerabilities that's having an early presentation of any one of these diagnoses: hypermobility, endometriosis, gut issues in terms of mast cell activation so that people aren't absorbing nutrients. So these are kind of the genetic underpinning diagnoses that are a risk factor. Another risk factor is simply being in a hormone transition when this happens. So it's either puberty, pregnancy, postpartum, or perimenopause. A third really interesting one, if it's not happening to you, really interesting from a science perspective, is women, when they are under chronic stress, have low cortisol. Men, interestingly, more likely have high cortisol under chronic stress. The question could be just that men seek and receive treatment earlier, because it could be a bit of a continuum. Low-grade, long-term stress could be high cortisol initially and then low cortisol later. But people can actually, with an acute stressor or just lots of chronic stress, be in just low cortisol. And women tend to be in that more often. So it's a very consistent correlation among having low cortisol and being at risk for long COVID. And so long COVID to me is just representative of some of these other post-viral illnesses, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And I think a lot of women out there listening are checking a lot of boxes as you're going through them. Okay, so you've decided to create a program that can help the women who kind of fit into this picture. And if this is viral related in some way, it would make sense that the introduction of COVID and the COVID vaccines and everything around COVID could kind of be like a big bad version of this, because it affects so many things systemically. And I also found it interesting that you mentioned that women get hit differently with COVID during luteal phase with lower estrogen. Is there research on that now? Like, is that an accepted medical thing?
Well, is it an accepted medical thing? Sort of. But there is research that women with lower estrogen are more likely to have long COVID. And those actually on hormone replacement therapy, or even on hormonal birth control. So in some ways, that's a little complicated, because hormonal birth control can actually lower total estrogen levels, but it keeps them really consistent. So whether you're on medical hormone therapy or hormonal birth control, your risk of getting COVID at all is decreased. So you're in a, of the vulnerability factors, having low estrogen when you're hit with any of these viral triggers or other stressful triggers is a risk factor. And then, on the expression side, We also know that the average age of long COVID is just younger, slightly younger than 47. So that's right in the midst of when women are in that kind of most commonly low. So perimenopause estrogen goes up and down for a couple of, you know, anywhere from 5 to 10, 15 years at the outside. But moment to moment, estrogen is declining over time in later perimenopause. And 47 would be kind of later perimenopause on average.
Okay, that makes sense. You were right at the average mark then when you got your long COVID. So it's always fascinating. I interview and talk to so many different practitioners with different specialties and focuses and things. And so often it reflects their own, like, I had to figure this out. So now I'm going to share it with everybody else, because I don't know if everybody out there listening knows your journey at all. And you mentioned that you went four and a half years. So you got it right at the beginning, COVID, kind of.
Yeah, mine is just under 4 years. So December of 2020.
Mm-hmm. And what were your, I know this could be its own podcast episode, but what happened? Like, what, you got sick and then you're like, I'm not getting better, or new symptoms came, or what, how did that go for you? And what were your, because I know long COVID can present in like a lot of different ways, but what was your primary presentation and symptoms? And then what's been the things that moved the needle for you?
Yeah. So to really kind of encapsulate this 4 year journey, I think it is important to kind of pull out the key bullet points, because this is how women are going to recognize that they even have COVID, I think, or have long COVID. I think the challenge with long COVID is it's so many different things, and it's so many degrees of disability that, and also we have this overlay of, you know, it's kind of like early days HIV. Like, there's a lot of stigma around it. So I don't blame you if you don't want to identify as having long COVID. The only reason I am is because I think it could be helpful to other people.
I learned more about it from your Facebook post than I learned from anywhere else. So it was helpful.
It's not a popular thing to talk about. And certainly in the wellness world, the idea is that if you are healthy enough, you won't get this. And that's just wrong. It's incorrect. And so I had COVID before vaccines. I had no vaccine. And I had a moderate case that kind of cratered in, you know, let's say 2 weeks in. I was kind of the normal, you know, I didn't feel well. I was feverish, that kind of thing. I actually wasn't even super feverish. Like, I was just kind of regular sick for like 5 or 6, 7 days. I don't remember exactly now. And then towards the end, I just had that quick decompensation to not being able to breathe and having really, really high heart rate. So I went to the hospital, into the ER, and in December of 2020, that in and of itself was kind of a scary experience, but didn't find any blood clots. You know, my lungs were fine enough that they just sent me home at that point. And basically, I just sat in bed and said to my husband, like, I hope I can keep breathing. Like, I feel like, I told him, I feel like when you're in labor and delivery, and I know this is like, as a man, you may not be able to relate to this, but maybe someone will be able to relate.
I've been there. I didn't do it.
So you're in there and you just don't know how long it's going to take. Like, you're in some significant discomfort. I had two babies, no epidurals. Like, I had some significant discomfort, but you're like, okay, I'm just at some point, this is going to be over. But my experience with long COVID was like, I really can't breathe very well. And I don't know if and when this is going to be over. Like, I'm just going to sit here and be very present and try to breathe. And eventually it got better. I got some IV fluids, which, knowing what I know now, shows me that at least to some extent, even that acute shortness of breath was probably related to dysautonomia more so than a lung problem. So COVID, the research is now showing, is more of like a brain injury and a vascular injury. Now, it does injure the lungs in some people, but I think of COVID as a car crash more than a cold, because you have to recover from it and that you have to heal the organ and vascular damage in the same way you would heal an injury than healing a mild respiratory infection. So I recovered from the acute COVID, but that experience of just trying to survive is a trauma that I still have to work on. So there's also the trauma of COVID that we can't separate from all of these other things. It's not just trauma of COVID. You know, you might have trauma of endometriosis or medical trauma from a surgery or trauma from just not being believed that you're feel like you're going to pass out. Your doctor might have told you 1,000 times, oh, it's just anxiety. It's not anxiety. It's not. It's a brain cardiovascular injury. And it doesn't necessarily have to just be triggered by COVID. It could be triggered by other infections, by vaccines, by a major life stressor. And you're not just anxious. But there is trauma there that has to be healed to kind of keep getting to the root. Okay. So I had a mild COVID infection per the definitions of December of 2020, but it was rough. Then I just didn't really get better. Couldn't stand up, had a lot of chest pain, thought I was going to pass out in the shower all the time. Again, dysautonomia, which I didn't have before that. And I had myocarditis. So I also had a heart injury, and I probably had a lung injury. It's a little hard to say now because at some point, like a year and a half after that, I did go and get a pretty major stem cell infusion. Not something I would necessarily recommend now unless somebody has true organ damage of their lungs, heart. That I do think it was helpful for, but it does not help like the fatigue and the other three, four things that we talked about before, the dysautonomia, the chronic fatigue, the histamine issues, and the hypermobility. So I then did, the other symptom I had for a really long time in the very first like 8 months was my entire body, it felt like all my vessels were burning, like just absolutely on fire all the time. I just sort of got used to it. Thus, and now I know that was probably the mast cell activation piece of this. Now, at the time, and I had a ton of hot flashes, lots of heat, lots of night sweats. And of course, I was 47-ish, 48 by this point, 47, 48. And I was like, oh, must be perimenopause, because COVID can also put women acutely, and we do have research about this, into premature menopause, which did happen to me. I was in perimenopause, but I had a very abrupt menopause right after that acute COVID infection. I had maybe one other minor cycle, but that was it. It was an abrupt menopause. So I thought about hormone replacement therapy, but was concerned because of my vascular symptoms, because there is a risk of blood clotting with certain kinds of estrogen replacement therapy. And I asked that question to multiple people who had no idea, because we didn't know in 2021 if it was safe or not safe to take hormone therapies with COVID. It since does not seem to be additive in terms of more cardiovascular risk to add transdermal estrogen, and in fact may help. But estrogen is also a mast cell, it stimulates mast cell degranulation. So for me, adding hormones at first made a lot of the symptoms worse. So you've really got to kind of do this in order, which is why we developed this program. You have to kind of open your detox pathways. You have to stabilize your immune system and your histamine response. And you do have to get the body-brain coordination starting to heal, because the nervous system upregulation does exacerbate this entire picture. And it's very, very sensitive when someone has COVID and perimenopause at the same time, or any other infection or vaccination and perimenopause at the same time, or endometriosis and perimenopause. Like, it's not only COVID, but COVID is so, so common now that I think we have to keep it as a part of the conversation when most of the medical system, including the integrative medical system, including the wellness system, has decided to ignore it. But it is right now one of our key risk factors for cardiovascular disease and symptoms of chronic illness at the menopause transition.
Okay, a lot to digest there. Thank you for sharing all of that. It's I was witnessing as you were trying to like make sense of it as you went. So it's
try to simplify it. It's
yeah. Now it's like now it's a little like I mean when it was actually happening, I was watching you trying to make sense of it. Not this was much more concise, but every time I would read one of your updates, it was like a little bit more pieces to the puzzle. And I like that you bring up it's more like an injury than like a cold you can't get over. It's more like a car accident or something to the brain and the vascular system, because that's what it kind of seemed like initially when long COVID started happening. I was like, these are the same symptoms people have from like TBIs and and like strokes and like clotting issues and like not normal cold things. When people, the wellness industry, you know, people are like, oh, it's a cold. Colds don't make people have strokes, and colds don't like, this is a different ball game that this is playing. And so now they've learned a lot of the things about why that was happening. I saw you post about the test, the microclot test.
Microclotting test, yeah.
Yeah, I looked it up after you posted about it. That was the first place I'd seen it. And that's really good that that's starting to be available, because half the time, and it doesn't just go with COVID, it goes with a lot of these other conditions or autoimmunity or anything, it's crazy making to be told that you're fine.
Yes.
When you feel terrible. So if there's a test that can kind of identify some of this taking place real time, it'd be beneficial, if for nothing else, just to make sure that somebody's not being made to be crazy, that their symptoms are validated, right? So
in our program, we do facilitate or just plain offer all of the testing. We have a nurse practitioner on the team. I think every resource in long COVID, but we are nurse practitioners, also a NAMS specialist in menopause care. So hormones, peptides, all of that we can facilitate or offer depending on where someone lives. And these are really important lab tests to get, both conventional and functional, because as you said, so for example, I had the microclotting test, which is one thing to show one of the reasons why you might be so fatigued. And it's interesting, mine showed up pretty high, but of a certain kind of microclotting, which may actually be more like, you know how you can get a back MRI and you can have tons of like bone spurs and stuff, and it doesn't really mean anything. The kind of microclotting I have, they're doing really good research right now at Mount Sinai in New York that is showing that that kind of microclotting may just be normal. Oh. And so that's valuable. But there is another kind related to platelet clotting that is more indicative of a problem with being able, like your blood can look fully oxygenated, but you cannot get that oxygen to your tissues. So of course, you feel like crap when after you're more active, you know. So mine may or may not have some relationship to that, but there are multiple things going on. And one thing that's nice to say, so we developed this program because there are so few options for science-based care of all of these conditions together. And Mount Sinai actually is just opening their first center to begin to look at this, but they can only take 700 patients a year. And that's great. They're going to be doing a lot of research. I applaud that center. But, you know, we need thousands more. There are probably 20 million people in the United States alone with long COVID right now. And the vast majority are concentrated in women in midlife.
20 million. Are there numbers on that? Like, I know there's no official diagnosis.
There is
tool.
A diagnosis code.
Is there?
Yeah.
Is there now? Is it how, like, to get diagnosed for Hashimoto's, technically your body has to have like eaten a certain percentage of your thyroid till it almost doesn't exist anymore. So people have Hashimoto's way before they have Hashimoto's. But like how, I don't know the right word to use.
How do you get long COVID
or realistic
diagnosed?
Or like how legit is that?
Yeah, we don't have like one test because long COVID is so many different things. But there is a diagnosis code for long COVID, and you can be screened for long COVID. It's more like a syndrome sort of, you know, of a number of different kinds of symptoms.
You check
like,
enough of these boxes.
Mm-hmm. And there are long COVID centers. I've been to the one at Yale, which was okay, you know, in terms of just doing some basic pulmonary function tests, but they're not good in terms of looking at this whole picture, because hospitals, especially teaching hospitals, are so divided into subspecialties.
Yeah.
And they can only offer certain therapies because they have to have really strong randomized controlled data behind them. And this is so new that there's very few therapies that do. They are trying to stay on the leading edge at some level. Like I did get access to hospital grade hyperbaric oxygen therapy through Yale, which was a really valuable piece of the puzzle. Some centers are prescribing low dose naltrexone, which wasn't helpful for me, but really helpful for others because, again, it's that brain inflammation that seems to be driving a lot of this. So that's been really helpful. So we have the capacity to kind of pull together all these different resources. I know we're basically all of them are. And sometimes they're just kind of obscure because none of this is very mainstream yet. But the data on how many people have long COVID, it's 10% per infection. So like if you've had one infection, your risk of having long COVID is 10%. But there's some data out of Canada that shows that multiple infections amplifies that risk. And we have actually confirmed studies on that as well. So if you've had three infections, your risk is 40%. So for me,
by those numbers, in 10 years or so, everyone's going to have long COVID.
100%. Yes. We will no longer have energetic music shows. I saw somebody talking about this. They're exactly right. This is absolutely pervasive in the population because we don't have the capacity to give people the time to fully recover. And we are no longer doing absolutely anything for mitigation. If I go anywhere in public, I am wearing an N95 mask. I would 100% recommend everybody do this, but it's so socially unacceptable and difficult that I don't even require my children to do it. My biggest risk is actually just that my kids are in school. My daughter's school does have HEPA filters in all her classrooms, but we had to do that. And I was happy to, but I mean, it's crazy. We know that HEPA filters in schools reduce all infection, even in like baby schools, like preschools, by a third. The fact that we don't have this nationwide is ridiculous. And right now, what we're seeing is the manifestation of long COVID in ways that the medical community and just everyone is ignoring. We have a huge bump right now in the United States of mycoplasma pneumonia. That is long COVID. That is because the immune systems of everyone have been rocked. So I don't see a possibility where you are not going to be affected by this at some point in the next 10 to 15 years. This is, you know, it damages the immune system's ability to fight off every other illness unless you fully recover it, which is so hard to do if you keep getting infected every 6 to 12 months.
And you don't get to do the things.
You don't know
what the things are, and you don't get to do them. Like, you don't get time to do them. You don't, like, there's not the ability to get them or access them. You don't even know what they are. You can't get off work. Your life doesn't slow down. Like, you're expected to go back to, do you even get time off in the States right now if you're, like, actively have a COVID infection? Does that, like, get you to not have to go to, I remember when it was, like, you had to barricade yourself in your house for 2 weeks. When I first got to Italy, it was, like, the law.
Yeah.
That you had to be in your house for a certain amount of time. I think it was 10 days.
Yeah.
And that you couldn't get your green pass back until you tested negative or something. And now I don't know if you could even like call in to work with COVID in the States. Like, it's just like, just go ahead. So there's no one that's, and I've never tested positive. I've gotten sick twice to where I thought for sure I had COVID, and I tested negative a bunch of times each time. And then one time Mira had it while I was like, she tested positive and Elio tested positive and I tested negative and I was sick and I tested and tested and tested and was always negative. I don't know how common that is. So I'm assuming I had it.
Yeah, yeah. And right. depending on which strain, you probably did. But here's my hope. My hope is that the reality is, because all of us have some degree of immunity, that we're building some kind of strength to this. But the data is not really showing that. The data is really showing that each infection makes your immune system weaker. And as you just mentioned, it's extremely rare. What the most important thing you need to do, I have a friend who has acute COVID right now. She announced it. And I said, look, take 10 to 14 days off work and do not exercise for the next 6 to 12 weeks. Gently move around your life, heal your body as if you were in a car accident. And that is so impossible to do in just the capitalistic society that we live in for 85, 90% of people, because even if you don't have a job, you might have kids or aging mm-hmm. parents or something else, right? I don't see a way where this is not going to affect everyone in the next 10 years, because the problem is we're not calling it COVID anymore. I've seen a million videos about mycoplasma pneumonia. We have papers about showing that COVID, acute COVID in adults triggered mycoplasma pneumonia. Not a soul, not a doctor is talking about this. And so the problem is,
I don't know why this is happening.
Yeah. It keeps being like, oh, why do the NFL
players?
There's
a bunch of really strange extreme spikes in conditions that used to be not so common in demographics where they were really uncommon.
Yes.
That everyone's like, wow, this is all so weird. And it has a common denominator that it all started in 2020 and no one can figure it out. And no one's like, wow, like colon cancer in young people has gone up like some insane percentage in very short amount of time. I've been reading about a few different ones that it's like, and the article is always like, oh, it's a mystery. It's like, is it though? Like, is it a mystery or do we just not want to name what it is because we can't fix it? Call.
Yeah, that's the answer.
Because you can't put the genie back in the bottle. Like there's no going backwards to stop it. And it's kind of like the analogy, and this is scary and sad, but funny at the same time, because if you don't weave humor into things, I think it makes it worse. But like when the coyote's chasing the roadrunner and he runs over the edge of the cliff, but he doesn't fall right away. And he's like looking around and then he notices that he's not on the ground and then he falls. I think we're like in the looking around. And not the falling. Like, and
we
it's
are.
Like, you can't, this is going to become its own branch of medicine. It already kind of is starting to, like, it's going to have to become its own thing, like its own heart disease, cancer, COVID, and COVID studies and long COVID and everything related to long COVID. And I don't think most people realize that. I think most people think this is a thing that happened. And then it's kind of done, and like, oh, so and so has COVID again, or oh, I had COVID again, or what, like, whatever. And then everybody's kind of gradually functioning at a lower level than they were. And it's like the frog in the water analogy. For some people, it's really drastic. Like for you, it was really drastic. Like you were like, I can't exist like this. Like I have to do things because your arteries are on fire and you can't exercise. Like, but for the people who have it, to where it's like affecting like memory or affecting anxiety, or everyone already has poor memory and anxiety. So it's just compounding things that are really common already due to a whole bunch of other podcast topic reasons. So it's kind of like sneaky in a way, unless it totally rips you off your feet.
That's 100% true. And the wellness answer to this is it's the vaccines. But the reality is that's just not true.
Yeah, but it's happening to a lot of people who didn't have vaccines.
Yes. And I'm not saying that the vaccines aren't irritating people and aren't injuring some people. They aren't good for some people. They are life-saving for other people. They're a tool. They're not like, you know,
I got one of them and I really didn't want to. And I don't usually talk about it. I didn't really want to get it, but I did for a lot of reasons when we were moving, because it made life easier. Mm-hmm. And I had concerns about it. I got sick as hell, and like sicker than I was the two times I said I was sick. But there are plenty of people documented who have long COVID or really, or died from COVID, really died from COVID, serious COVID infections, hospitalizations, long COVID, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, who never had a vaccine. So
100%. It's
not, that idea is silly. And it's just confirmation bias. It's like, I want this to be true, so it's true. So I'm going to go with that, which we're recording this a couple of weeks before an election in the U.S., where that could be also said for a lot of things. So, wow. So the program sounds awesome. You're launching it now through your same institute where you're educating doctors, practitioners, through your Integrative Women's Health Institute, which is at integrativewomenshealthinstitute.com.
Yes.
When is it? Is it going to be like a thing that starts and ends? Is it going to be a thing that anybody can join and you can take care of them anytime? How does it work and what is it called?
Yes, it's called the Menopause Solution. You'll see a big button on that website at theintegrativewomenshealthinstitute.com. And we have rolling admissions. You have to talk to myself and our coaching team to make sure you are a right fit for that program. But if you are, we can, starting today, take people into
starting today.
Mm-hmm. Starting today.
Today is October 24th. You're recording podcasts on the day that the program you've been working on went live?
Yeah. Well, I have a team.
They're doing a great job. I know, but I always get scared to schedule anything on days where things go live because then I get a lot of messages about things going, which way they're going. But congratulations. Yeah. I didn't know that. And so, but it's not just for menopause. It's a lot of these things that we're talking about here. This confluence of symptoms and that tend to stir the menopause pot a little heartier and cause it to be a lot more debilitating and difficult than otherwise would be.
And we call it the Menopause Solution because it is hard to identify what the heck all those other things are.
Yeah.
Because of all the reasons we just talked about. So if you're in perimenopause and you feel unwell, or if you're in midlife, anywhere between 35 and 55, and you feel unwell, this is the program for you.
Yeah, it sounds awesome. I'm going to have to get some more details because we'll have to send some women in our community your way. And yeah, the diagnosis path for most of those things that you listed at the beginning around mast cell activation syndrome, POTS, chronic fatigue, EDS, endometriosis, probably the fastest. Well, even that one has a delayed diagnosis, but like out of those, that one may be the fastest to get diagnosed, even if it's years. Yeah. A lot of those conditions, I meet the people after they know those terms and they have those terms and I have this, this, and this. That woman was the unwell lady for a whole bunch of years, seeing a whole bunch of doctors, being told she was fine and given a whole bunch of hooey for a really long time before she knew what POTS was.
Absolutely.
And so yeah, if you're just, you also named a lot of symptoms and a lot of signs and a lot of side effects and a lot of things from both the long COVID and all those conditions and the drop in hormones and the huge hormone swing. So if you're a lady out there and you're hearing yourself and anything that was talked about here, I would go over there. We'll put the links where the links go and find your way to that. So thank you for sharing all of this. Thank you for so publicly sharing all the wild stuff you went through and did as you were trying to get well. Because I know it was not just me who was like, I kept up to date on what was going on with long COVID through your updates. Because it got to the point where I was like, I can't read all this shit anymore. I'll just see what Jessica posted. And then I'll go back and I'll read your post and be like, okay, I'm up to speed now. Because it's so much. There's so much overload of maybes and possiblys and could or whatever. So thank you for putting it all together and turning what was not an awesome thing that happened into something that can help a lot of people. And I think that it's important, like that's a gift to like take our things that happen to us and turn them into things that we can use to help other people. So I know there's a term for that. I'm not coming up with it, but thank you for that. And thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.